Thank you for listening to KMXT on 100.1 FM. It's your public radio station. Stay tuned for the Midday Report, coming right up. 54 degrees here in Kodiak. We're looking for rain today and tomorrow. The good news is, Wednesday, it's looking like partly sunny, and those sunny conditions are expected to continue through Sunday, at least. First, NPR News.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Democrats in the Texas legislature are planning another revolt today against legislation that Republican backers say will protect elections, but opponents warn will enable voter suppression. Houston Public Media's Andrew Schneider has more on the Democrats' battle for voting rights playing out in Texas and other red states.
Two priority bills for Texas Republicans would ban drive-through voting and 24-hour voting, make mail-in voting more difficult, and increase criminal penalties for voting mistakes. In response, Democratic lawmakers are leaving the state, possibly for the rest of the special session, which is set to run into August. It would be the first time in 18 years that Democrats had fled the state to break quorum. Similar voting legislation died at the end of the regular legislative session in May when Democrats walked out in the final moments, breaking quorum. That led Republican Governor Greg Abbott to call for the special session. I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
94 people are now confirmed dead in the partial collapse of a condo building in Surfside, Florida. A majority of families have been notified, but with the search now in its 19th day, responders are increasingly relying on the medical examiner's office to help identify the remains. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's calling for free and fair elections in Haiti, where the leadership is in disarray after President Jovenel Moïse was assassinated last week. NPR's Carrie Khan reports authorities have arrested a Florida-based doctor of Haitian descent whom they believe may have been the central figure in the attack.
Haiti's national police chief said officers had arrested 63-year-old Christian Emmanuel Sanon. During a search of his home in Haiti, police found bullets, license plates from the Dominican Republic, and a hat with a DEA logo. Authorities had arrested more than a dozen other suspects in the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse last Wednesday. Most are Colombians, two are Haitian Americans. Haiti's police chief suggested at a news conference that Sanon, who says he is a doctor, was plotting to become president of Haiti and had hired the other suspects to protect him while in the Caribbean nation. The murder has plunged Haiti into turmoil with no clear consensus on who is running the country at this time. Carrie Khan, NPR News.
The 20-year-long U.S. military mission in Afghanistan ends next month. NPR's Tom Bowman says the country moved closer to that goal today when the top American officer in Afghanistan, General Scott Miller, stepped down.
During a small ceremony in Kabul, Miller turned over the combat mission to General Frank McKenzie, who oversees Middle East operations from Tampa, Florida. McKenzie will have authority to mount airstrikes against al-Qaeda and Islamic State targets. The U.S. will also maintain security force at the U.S. Embassy and the Kabul airport. The U.S. has promised continued financial aid to the Afghan military. It's not the end of the story, McKenzie said. It's the end of a chapter. Tom Bowman, NPR News.
It's NPR.
NPR News is presentada a usted en parte por la Providence Kodiak Island Centro de Asesoramiento. Para una cita o más información, por favor, llama al 907-481-2400.
Governor Mike Dunleavy vetoed the money that would pay for lawmakers' daily expenses during the legislative session. He said it doesn't make sense for legislators to receive the money until they've resolved the future of permanent fund dividends. But some are concerned about the short and long-term impacts it will have on the legislature. Alaska Public Media and KTOO's Andrew Kitchenman has this report.
The legislature passed a budget that included roughly $2 million to pay for the daily food and housing needs of lawmakers and their families attending the session. This year, the payments, known as per diems, equaled $293 per day. It's based on the rate the federal government pays its employees when they're traveling in Alaska. Governor Dunleavy said the day after vetoing the money that he knew the veto would not be appreciated by some legislators.
Every day a legislator is in session, they get close to $300 to pay for expenses. And I certainly understand that those expenses have to be offset. But we've had two special sessions in which thousands of dollars was collected by members of the legislature, and at the same time, the permanent fund and the permanent fund dividend was not dealt with.
Dunleavy, a Republican, has proposed changing the PFD formula through an amendment to the state constitution. It would be based on half of the amount the state draws annually from the permanent fund. This year, that amount would lead to a PFD of roughly $2,350. Committees in both the House of Representatives and the Senate held hearings on the amendment during the special session, but neither chamber has held a vote on it. Anchorage Democratic Representative Matt Klayman chaired one of those hearings. Klayman is concerned that the governor is trying to pressure the legislature to take his position on dividends at a time when Alaskans need to know more about all of the effects of Dunleavy's PFD proposal. Klayman says the tactic won't increase cooperation.
I hear the pressure, and I think if the governor's way of trying to apply that pressure is to say, I'm going to take away the funds that provide expenses so the legislature can work, I mean, that doesn't seem like it's likely to accelerate the process because some legislators may not be able to come to Juneau at all without the per diem.
Klayman says the per diems are essential to drawing a diverse range of Alaskans to run for the legislature.
For me, this really comes back to, are we trying to make the legislature something that people from all walks of Alaska could serve in?
Without per diems, he fears it would limit the number of people who could afford to become legislators. Annual legislative salaries have been set at $50,400 since 2009. The per diems at the current rate can reach as high as roughly $35,000 for a 121-day session. Several Republican legislators did not return calls for this story. Anchorage lawyer Scott Kendall served as chief of staff to Dunleavy's predecessor, Governor Bill Walker. Kendall says he never and would never advise a governor to veto money that legislators use to cover their expenses. Kendall says Dunleavy has a history of attacking other branches of government, including vetoing court system funding due to his opposition to court rulings on abortion. That veto became one of the grounds for recall in the campaign to remove Dunleavy from office. Kendall has advised the recall campaign.
I'm not concerned about future governors doing this. I think, you know, most people respect the norms and have the common sense not to engage in a back and forth between branches of government.
Kendall says that if Dunleavy maintains the veto, the legislature could eliminate appropriations for some of the costs of the governor's office. Kendall adds that Dunleavy's dividend proposal would require spending that would lead to an annual deficit of at least $1 billion. And he says that since Dunleavy proposed budget cuts 2 years ago that prompted a public outcry, the governor hasn't proposed policy changes to close the deficit. In Juneau, I'm Andrew Kitchenman.
The Wild Alaskan was scuttled after years of waiting following its impoundment in December 2017 as a port risk, according to the City of Kodiak press release. The tug Makushin Bay towed the Wild Alaskan out 75 miles southeast of Kodiak, where the sea chest valves in the hull were opened, and they sunk her at 9 p.m. Thursday night. The City of Kodiak sought and received permission to scuttle the vessel at sea. The Coast Guard and the Environmental Protection Agency worked alongside the city to arrange the scuttling, while harbor staff removed all hazardous materials and debris aboard the vessel. Within a set of glaciers and mountains near Juneau, there's seismic activity almost every day in the summer. They're called ice quakes, and while they're not as widely understood as earthquakes, researchers are monitoring them closely. KTOO's Matt Miller has this story.
This is a big iceberg in Antarctica, either scraping against the ocean bottom or another iceberg. It's called an ice quake. It's one of many types and probably quite similar to what has been happening almost every day for the last few weeks in the mountains and glaciers near Mount Ogden, about 40 miles directly east of Juneau. Southeast Alaska made headlines in some blogs and online news sites recently, with some people connecting them to the area's recent heat wave. Fact is, scientists have been studying them for a long, long time. They are not anything new. Seismologist Natalia Rupert of the Alaska Earthquake Center says there were 360 ice quakes in the area last year, including some significant shakers.
They were up to magnitude 3. And magnitude 3 is a quite significant signal that some of those ice quakes were reported to be felt in Juneau. So those were quite large.
This year, the ice quake started in May, with a big spike in activity starting 4 days before late June's heat wave in southeast Alaska. For those of you who might be new to ice quakes or glaciology, let's get a few things out of the way first. Scientists can't see or feel the quakes themselves, so they use seismometers. That's the same tool or piece of equipment that they use to detect earthquakes and measure their intensity.
Ice is always moving, ice is always deforming and cracking, and every time it moves, deforms, or cracks, it creates some energy that propagates in a form of seismic waves, and our seismic sensors are able to record that energy.
Ice quakes actually may be caused by many different things. A glacier scrapes against the bedrock, or a crevasse might open up. In Greenland and Antarctica, giant icebergs slowly breaking away from glaciers create vibrations that can be detected around the world. In Antarctica, scientists detected seismic activity which revealed how a giant river of ice lurches ahead into the ocean every 12 hours as the tide rises and falls. So, how do scientists know the difference between an earthquake and an ice quake when they're looking at the data? Turns out that data looks and even sounds different. You know those squiggly and jumpy lines on a seismometer graph as it records an earthquake? If you were to convert that to a sound file, the magnitude 9 earthquake in Japan in 2011 would sound like this. While ice quakes, like this calving iceberg in Greenland, don't have a lot of high frequencies and they start more gradually. Earthquake. Icequake. Earthquake. Icequake. Hear the difference? Glacial seismologist Rick Astor of Colorado State University says they've actually known about icequakes around Juneau, Wright Glacier, and Mount Ogden for decades. As the glacial ice flows down the valleys, Astor says friction and obstructions can slow it down. But then temperatures rise every spring and summer, and snowmelt and rainfall increases.
The seasonal influx of water into the glacier can make it more likely to slip. And in this case, the annual cycle of melting water and water getting under the glacier drives a seasonality to the occurrence of these ice quakes as the glacier slips at its base.
Astor says there are even practical applications for seismometers to detect ice quakes created by glacial outburst floods.
This is happening in Iceland now, for example, where they have enormous glacier floods, and the seismometers can detect when the water is coming out of the ice cap before it appears on the surface.
That was actually done very close to Juneau's Mendenhall Glacier a few years ago. A temporary seismometer was able to detect the ground shaking during a jökulhlaup, or a glacial outburst flood, because of the force of all that water gushing through cracks in the glacier. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Matt Miller.
At the turn of the 20th century, the federal government created boarding schools in an attempt to assimilate indigenous children into, quote, American society. The lasting legacy of the boarding school era devastated Native cultures across North America. Now, people all across the country are demanding accountability and working to bring those children home. KNBA's Trip Krause tells the story about one Alaska Native student buried in Pennsylvania in the early 1900s and her recent return to St. Paul.
Sophia Titoff wanted to come home.
Yeah, so Sophia is my grandmother's aunt, and so she's my great-grandfather's stepsister.
That's Lauren Peters, who's a Nunga and the Alaska Native advisor at Fort Ross Conservancy in California. Up until 4 years ago, Lauren Peters didn't even know Sophia existed, or that they were related. In fact, the way Peters tells it, Sophia found her. We'll get to that, but first, a little bit about Sophia. She was orphaned in the early 1900s when the measles epidemic hit Alaska and many Anunga, Yupik, and Nunupiat became infected. First her father died, then her mother. Sophia and her sister Irene were moved to Alaska. Irene died there. Then Sophia was taken all the way to a native boarding school, the Carlisle Indian Industrial School in Pennsylvania.
So it was, you know, going from St. Paul to Alaska, you know, it's what, 400 miles?
Mm-hmm.
But it's still, you know, it's still Anunga and it's still treeless and, you know, volcanic and windswept and all the, you know, beautiful weather. And then to go, you know, 4,000 miles, imagine landing it in Washington State and then going all across the plains into the big cities and whatnot. And then ending up at Carlisle, and I saw that.
Carlisle was established in 1879. It was a federally funded boarding school established by the military.
Around, and I was imagining how foreign that had been to her and how frightening that had been to end up in this landscape that you don't know anything about it. Must have been really disorienting.
Similar boarding schools were later established in Alaska. While the Carlisle site returned to military use in 1918, many other schools continue to operate into living memory. Many Alaskans have heard stories of schools in White Mountain, the Copper River Valley, the Wrangell Institute, and Mount Edgecombe, which continues to run as a public boarding school in Sitka. Barbara Landis is a former Carlisle Indian School Archives and Library Specialist for the Cumberland County Historical Society. Landis says she first became involved with the boarding school when tribes began reaching out to the Historical Society to track down information on Native students.
There are some universal issues, for example, children dying at boarding schools that touched every nation. So it's a really tricky episode in United States history and clearly in Canada's history also.
In 2021, news surfaced about ground-penetrating radar that was used to uncover locations of hundreds of unmarked graves at residential schools in Canada. Since the announcement about Kamloops, Landis has been fielding phone calls from families and media outlets.
I really believe that the Kamloops discovery has been a catalyst for people starting to become aware of the residential boarding school system, the mission schools, and the government-run schools.
U.S. Interior Secretary Deb Haaland announced a national initiative to investigate the traumatic legacy of boarding schools run by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Back to Sophia and Lauren. 4 years ago in California, Peters was working on an Alaska Native Day for Fort Ross. She invited Tlingit elder and storyteller Bob Sam. He's also a cemetery caretaker and works on repatriation.
And in 2017, he called me and said, hey, I've been trying to get the orphans at Carlisle deemed wards of the state. But since when they were taken, there wasn't a state. It was just proving impossible.
Sam asked whether she could track down information on students in the Anunga Alutiiq region and gave her six names, three from St. Paul and three from Kodiak. Sophia's was first on the list. Her name came up again at another conference. Peters researched Sophia's origins on St. Paul Island and traced the student's family tree, and branches with Peters' own family history matched up. Sophia's remains are the first Alaska Native student to be repatriated from the former school site. Peters hopes Sophia's story inspires others to seek the return of their ancestors.
Starting the process at Carlisle, I felt happy. I felt that she felt clever and brave and leading the Alaskans out of the cemetery. I just really admire her and felt really at peace and good about the whole process. And some other people who were trying to get their kids out of the cemetery at the same time were feeling the anguish of these children that are still stuck in there. And we, several of us, you know, got together and said, I feel like these children are saying, what about me? Aren't you going to take me? It was very powerful, but Sophia, with the process with Sophia, I felt really good at the end, and I'm really happy to be taking her back to St. Paul, and I'm really happy, you know, reuniting her with our family.
Lauren's 21-year-old son, Andrew, joined her at Carlisle to begin the process of returning Sophia's remains to St. Paul.
And I wanted him to have that connection to Sophia, and he was my absolute rock up there. He checked in with her. He made decisions about how he wanted her to be handled respectfully. And he put her to bed at the end and carried her to the ceremony and carried her out to be placed in the container that is taking her to St. Paul. And I'm really proud of him.
Family members of Carlisle students must fill out the Army-required affidavits to return the remains, and in many, many cases, the children were orphans when they arrived at Carlisle. The family can be very hard to find.
And so there's 13 more kids there, and then there's 50 or 67 children at Chemawa in Oregon that are Alaska Native. I want to show people that there is a path towards this, and it is a really straightforward path that they try to make as easy for the tribes as possible.
For more information, contact the Native American Boarding School Healing Coalition. You can call them at 612-354-7700. That number again is 612-354-7700. In Anchorage, I'm Trip Krause.
KMXT Local News is underwritten in part by
GCI. GCI has adjusted store hours across the state to keep our customers and employees as safe as possible during this time. The most up-to-date store hours are available on GCI.com.
This is Alaska Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. Where do most fishermen live in Alaska? And who's the biggest beneficiary of Alaska's fisheries? More fish facts after this.
Did you know that eating wild and sustainable Alaska seafood can boost your immune system? Learn more about Alaska seafood's many proven nutritional benefits at wildalaskaseafood.com.
Want to know where most fishermen live in Alaska, or what community is home to the most fishing boats? United Fishermen of Alaska provides fishing facts for every region of Alaska, plus the West Coast. The facts are updated through 2018, the most complete year available. At a glance, they show that nearly 8,700 permit holders fished in 2018. Just over 6,000 were Alaska residents. Over 21,000 crew licenses were purchased that year, split almost evenly between resident and non-residents. Alaska's seafood industry employed nearly 59,000 direct jobs, more than any other private sector. Homer is home to 615 fishing boats, and nearly 20% of its population fishes, earning $69 million in 2018. A total of 636 vessels call Kodiak Island home, and over 1,000 residents fish there, or 17.3% of the population. At Petersburg, nearly 24% of the population fishes for a living on 620 home-ported boats. Only 9 permit holders fished out of Dutch Harbor in Alaska, but its 8 big processing plants helped generate $8.2 million in fishery taxes, both to the region and the state. The state of Washington continues to be the biggest beneficiary of Alaska's fisheries. Over 6,047 Washington residents plus crew fished in Alaska in 2018. Of Alaska's total harvest of roughly 5.7 billion pounds, 4 billion pounds went to Washington residents. And of the total dockside value of over $1.9 billion, Washingtonians pocketed $900 million. Find links at alaskafishradio.com. Fish Radio is also brought to you by OBI Seafoods. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
This is the Alaska Department of Fish and Game with Kodiak Commercial Salmon Fishery Advisory Announcement Number 17. This announcement was issued 10:30 a.m. July 12th. There will be an 81-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Tuesday, July 13th to 9 p.m. Friday, July 16th in the Iduit Bay section of the Afognak District. As previously announced, there will be a 72-hour extension to the current commercial salmon fishing period from 9 p.m. Saturday, July 10th until 9 p.m. Tuesday, July 13th in the following areas: the Cape Alitak, Humpy Deadman, Alitak Bay, Mosier Bay, and Olga Bay sections of the Alitak District. There will be an 81-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Tuesday, July 13th to 9 p.m. Friday, July 16th in the following areas: the Northwest Kodiak District, except the Kajuyak Bay section, will remain closed. The Northeast Kodiak District, except the Buskin River section, will remain closed. The East Side Kodiak District and the Afognak District, except the Inner and Outer Katoy Bay sections, will remain closed. There will be a 57-hour commercial salmon fishing period from noon Tuesday, July 13th to 9 p.m. Thursday, July 15th in the mainland district. The outer Iqaluit section of the Southwest Kodiak District will remain open to commercial salmon fishing until further notice. Until further notice, in that portion of the Northwest Kodiak and Southwest Kodiak districts, south of the latitude of Cape Kuliak, Chinook salmon 28 inches or greater in length may not be retained by purse gear in the commercial fishery and must be returned to the water unharmed. Concerning the North Shelikof Strait fishery, short notice in-period closures may occur for seine fisheries in the seaward zones of the North Shelikof Strait area as designated in the North Shelikof Strait Sockeye Salmon Management Plan. Closure announcements may occur at 8:30 a.m., 10 a.m., noon, 2 p.m., 5 p.m., or 8 p.m. on VHF Channel 6. Cost recovery fisheries have begun in the Spiridon Bay Special Harvest Area, and the Spiridon Bay Special Harvest Area will remain closed to common property fishing. Fishing opportunities in the Spiridon Bay Special Harvest Area will be dependent on the ability to meet KRAA cost recovery needs. Cost recovery information can be obtained by calling 486-6559. Closed waters are shown on the Kodiak Area Salmon Statistical Chart and detailed in the Commercial Salmon Fishing Regulations. Statistical charts, harvest strategies, and commercial salmon fishing regulations are available at the Kodiak Fish and Game Office. Recent salmon fishery information may be obtained by calling the department's 24-hour recorder phone at 486-4559.
Welcome to your Island Messenger for Monday. It is the 12th day of July, the year 2021. The sun rose today at 5:28. It won't set again until 11:01, giving us 17 hours and 34 minutes of daylight, a loss of 2 minutes and 49 seconds compared to yesterday. The record high for this date was 81, set in both 93 and 04, and the record low was 38, set in 1927. 54 degrees right now here in Kodiak. The temperature actually has been dropping. We're looking for likely rain today, cloudy skies. High near 58, we might not make that. North wind to 20, chance of precipitation is 70%. 50% chance of rain tonight. Cloudy skies overnight with a low around 51. Northwest winds to 10. For tomorrow, rain is likely before 2 p.m., then just scattered showers and cloudy skies. High near 57 tomorrow with a northwest wind to 15. And the good news is, on Wednesday, partly sunny skies, high near 61, and those sunny conditions are expected to go on until Sunday, it looks like, at least. Looking at our local tides, we have a high tide coming up here on the east side at 5:05 this afternoon. It will be a 6.9-foot tide, followed by a low tide at 10:17 this evening of 2.5 feet. Our middle-of-the-night tide will be a high tide at 4:19 a.m. That's going to be 8.9 feet. And our low tide for tomorrow morning will be 11:04 and be a minus 1 foot tide here on the east side. Over on the west side, you have a high tide coming up at 5:21 this afternoon. That will be 13.2 feet, followed by a low tide at 11:07 p.m. at 2.5 feet. Your next high tide will be at 4:55 a.m. and be 13.9 feet, followed by a low tide on the west side at 11:32 a.m. of minus 1.6 feet. Mariners, you do have a small craft advisory for Marmot Island to Sitkan at Kodiak's east side offshore. They're calling for northwest 20, except for north 25, north of Dangerous Cape, seas to 10 feet. For tomorrow, north 15, seas coming down to 5 feet. Over in the Shelikof, west wind to 20 knots right now, seas to 5 feet, should subside to 3 feet this afternoon. For tomorrow, southeast 15, seas to 4 feet. Well, we're pleased to announce a special Talk of the Rock here on KMXT tomorrow. Speaker of the House and Kodiak Representative Louise Stutes will be joining us live tomorrow afternoon at 12:30 to discuss the Alaska State Legislature right here on KMXT at 100.1 FM tomorrow at 12:30 for your Talk of the Rock, Louise Stutes. Nominating petitions for 1 2-year city council or city mayor seat and 2 3-year city council seats are now available at city clerk's office. For more information, call the clerk at 486-8636.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT 2 times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m. and during the midday report at 1220. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.